Welcome back. I meant to say earlier, and someone reminded me that we are starting a brand new adult class on Monday nights, and we would really love, I think everybody involved in the class enjoys it. I think that's why they get on every week, but also I think we would all enjoy seeing other people, seeing more people. It is a Zoom class that we have been studying the book of Acts. But now we'll be studying the book of Ephesians, and several of our men are going to be teaching each chapter, and that's at 7 o'clock on Mondays. And we would just love for you to join us and have a bunch of different boxes of people on Zoom. The links should be like on the weekly recap. David sent out an email announcing it. The link was in his email from this last week. Zoom is pretty versatile. So that you can do just audio if you want. You don't have to have video, or you can have video and audio. You can obviously have it up and be on mute, or not be on mute if you'd like to participate as well. Tomorrow, I'd encourage everybody to carve out some time, even with your family, to join us at 7 o'clock as, is it HE is doing the first one? Remember? HE is going to lead us in a study of Ephesians chapter 1 tomorrow at 7 o'clock. Okay, for now, speaking of our class here, we are doing quite a bit of a review today. And so the review handout, I think, will make it a lot easier to follow along, at least to see where we're going. And this is on the website, bellairchurchofchrist.org. And if you go to media, you can go to Bible classes or go to all audio, and Jeremiah class 39 will be there on the top of that list or toward the top of that list, and you can click to see the file for the PDF that includes this handout. As we've done before, what we'll do is each slide will be kind of one section of the handout, and so I'll show you the slide. You can look at that. If you have your handout in front of you, you can be filling out what's on it. I'll give you a minute or so to fill it out, to discuss with those that you're watching with at home what goes in those blanks or how to answer the questions, and then we will, you know, pop back in and go over them kind of section by section as we move through the review. Because we are, we'll see today by the end of class, we are at a big section break in the book of Jeremiah. We're almost to the end. We just have a few chapters left, and the rest of the material is distinct. It's different from what we've read up to this point. And so we're stopping here after 45 chapters to review the book about what Jeremiah's purpose was as a prophet, the history of Israel leading up to Jeremiah, Jeremiah's contemporary history, and then some of the things that we've seen in the book so far. So get your handout ready, or just play along on the screen in front of you, yell out the answers, again, like it's Wheel of Fortune or Jeopardy, and we'll have fun with this together. Okay, let's start by this. There's three things, and I on the handout, I gave you kind of the sentence starter, so I know I made it kind of easy for you, or easier than not. But take a minute or so, and we'll go mute here, remember what are the three things that are the prophet's purpose. What do we got? Are you here, buddy? This is not going live, so you won't, don't be embarrassed.
History.
Interpret history, yeah.
Enforce the covenants,
yeah. Yeah, declare the future, declare future events, yeah. I took events off because it was making me drop down a line and mess with my formatting, so. That kind of stuff is very important to me. All right, we can go back.
Ready.
Okay, the folks here got all of them, so maybe you did at home, but the prophet's purpose, to interpret history. We've seen a lot of this in Jeremiah. Maybe this more than any of the others to some degree, and probably with all of the prophets, this may be the main concern of theirs. We've maybe mentioned this before. There's a theory out there that the book of 1st and 2nd Kings was written by Jeremiah, okay? We don't know if that's true or not. It's interesting. But 1st and 2nd Kings was probably written by a prophet, and even just that fact, I think, makes this point, right? Because what is the book of 1 and 2 Kings all about? It's telling the story of Israel's history. Just to record it, just as interesting facts? No. It's telling the story to show what it is that God was doing throughout their history, okay? And so even in Jeremiah's messages, as we've seen in this book, that's what he's doing. This is what's happening with the Babylonians or with the Egyptians or with the kings of Judah. But let's pull back the curtain and see why is that happening. It's because God is doing X, Y, or Z, okay? Related to that, of course, is the fact that the prophets were trying to enforce the covenants for Israel. Several covenants we could talk about, but even just think about the covenant with Moses or the law of Moses, okay? It was very clear in Leviticus and Deuteronomy to say, if you do this, keep the covenant, this is the result of that. If you do this and disobey the covenant, then this will be the result. And someone like Jeremiah is saying, you have not kept the covenant. Therefore, the terms are clear. This is what is transpiring or going to transpire because of what you have done or not done. Okay, so the prophets do that. They hold Israel accountable for the covenants that they have made with God, or they remind Israel of the covenant that God has made with them, for instance, like with David, to put a king on the throne forever, and remind them God's going to do that. So just be waiting for that fulfillment. And then finally, the prophets do declare future events. Not the majority of what they do, but it is included in what they do. And so, for instance, Jeremiah will say things like, 70 years and the captivity will be over. Or, there is a king coming from the line of David, and he will reign in justice and righteousness. So the prophets declare future events as well. Okay, in terms of the themes that are in the prophets, we have a chart that looks like this. And I'll give you 30 seconds or so, because this one should be a little bit more familiar, to fill in the four R words that describe the themes that the prophets are always harping on. Yeah, go for it. Yell it out. I think we're muted now, so.
Rebellion.
Rebellion. Retribution. Yeah, I think Robert said restoration. You were jumping ahead, right? Yeah, at the end. And repentance, yeah, is the crossover. All right, what did you say? Retribution. Yeah. Okay, the four R words, again, we've seen these quite a bit, even going back to our study of Jeremiah. It is the rebellion of Israel, of God's people, that is this perpetual downslide, I guess that's a word, sliding down the deterioration of their society, so on and so forth, even after warning, they're rebelling against God, until God finally brings the retribution on them and punishes them for their sins. But there is a restoration that is promised, a hope of redemption, of reconciliation, of all that good stuff, okay? But all along, there is this offer of repentance, okay? And that is the pathway to God's restoration. And at least for some of Israel's history, the retribution can be avoided, the disaster can be avoided, like in the days of Hezekiah, for instance, if the people will repent and trust in God, okay? There's a couple ways to see this, we've said before. You could see this chart as something like what we talk about in the book of Judges, which is that this is really in some ways an ongoing cycle of God's people in the Old Testament. They rebel, God punishes them, there's some sort of deliverance, they kind of, you know, rise up again to some level of righteousness and security, and then they rebel again. But you can also see this chart as the long arc of Israel's history, and the rebellion is like everything leading up to the time of Jeremiah, and then in the time of Jeremiah, God is finally bringing on the people what he's been promising all along, which is the big punishment, the big one, so to speak, where he removes them from their land and destroys the temple. But then after that, there is the restoration that God has promised that will take place after the exile. Okay, So that's the themes that we see in the prophet. Let's talk about the historical context of Jeremiah. You'll have to look at your worksheet if you have this. If you don't, I'll just basically say that the chart that's going to appear is the same chart I've shown you over and over and over again about the history of Israel. And basically what I want you to try to come up with is what's the northern kingdom? What is it called? What is the southern kingdom called? Can you name a couple kings from each kingdom? And can you name who the nation that destroyed each kingdom? And then identify where in all of that Jeremiah was prophesying. So I'll give you a minute or so to get all that figured out. So my goal this year in my Bible reading is to memorize all the kings of Judah and Israel. I think there's like 19 or something in each. Have you ever done that? I never did that. Like, oh, is there a song? Man. It's one of the kids' songs? Rehoboam, Ahijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat. I don't know. oh gosh, Gilligan's Island or something. Okay, we're good. All right, so we start with the United Kingdom. That wasn't part of your quiz here, but we remember the glory days to some degree of Israel under Saul, David, really, and Solomon. But then there is a division after that in the days of Solomon's son. And so we have a northern kingdom called Israel and a capital most of the time in Samaria. And this is where we find figures like Jeroboam, who introduced the calf worship in Dan and Bethel, and Ahab, who institutionalized or nationalized at least Baal worship in Israel and is kind of like the big bad wolf of the story of the book of Kings. But eventually Israel will come to an end because of the Assyrians, who will really destroy them. And not so much take them all together in one group to Assyria. That wasn't Assyria's style. The Assyrians would come in, conquer a people, and then scatter their people all over other parts of their conquered territory to really, you know, disorient them, disunify them, and wield their power. Okay. But in the southern kingdom, we have what's called Judah. It's mainly the tribe of Judah, along with a couple other tribes that get kind of absorbed into that. And this is where we find people like Hezekiah, who we've mentioned, and then Josiah, who we'll talk more about in a second. But eventually, later on, when Babylon, look at this. I said Assyria, and my phone pulled up Siri and has been trying to take in every word I've said over the last 30 seconds. These phones are called smart, but I'm not sure they're always as smart as we think they are. The Babylonians come in, and they are now the superpower in the region, and they would take people whole, mostly, and bring them to Babylon to live there, to indoctrinate them in Babylonian culture and ways and stuff like that. And so that's what happens to Judah until there are a few people that return with under the Persians later on after the Babylonians are overthrown and rebuild in Judah and Jerusalem. Okay, in all of this, Jeremiah is right here as Babylonian captivity is becoming a reality. And so he is watching all of this unfold at the very end in the time of Josiah and his sons. This is probably the hardest thing on here. All of the four names that are confusing and sound alike that are the kings after Josiah. But take a minute or so, see if you can remember the four sons, grandsons of Josiah that reign after him. Anybody want to do it? Jehoahaz. Of course, there's another Jehoahaz who's king of Israel. I'm learning that in my Bible readings. Jehoiachin. Jehoiakim is first, then Jehoiachin. And then our boy Zed. Okay, we're all right. I'll stop torturing you on this one here. Real quickly, go over just some things we remember about these kings. Josiah is the last good king, great king, really, of Judah, and institutes a lot of reforms in his day. Actually, delays the destruction of Jerusalem because of his goodness. But he makes a foolish decision to try to stop Pharaoh, and Pharaoh kills him in the valley of Megiddo. And so his son Jehoahaz is put on the throne, but is almost immediately removed by Pharaoh, who again is controlling things in the area for the time being. And so Jehoiakim is instated by Pharaoh. This is just another one of Josiah's sons. And he reigns for 11 years. And it's during that 11-year reign, and in about the year 605, that Egypt's power finally gives way to Babylon, as Babylon takes over this region. And they will take, as we read in the book of Daniel chapter 1, the first wave of captives into Babylonian captivity. Okay, Jehoiakim dies a natural death, leaving the throne for his son Jehoiachin. But probably because of Jehoiakim's rebellion against Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar does not look kindly on Judah and on Jehoiachin in particular. So it is in this three-month time period of Jehoiachin that Nebuchadnezzar attacks the city and takes the next wave of captives into Babylon. And instead of Jehoiachin, who is now in Babylon, he puts on the throne in Jerusalem Zedekiah, another son of Josiah's, and he reigns for 11 years, and it is at the end of his reign, after rebelling again against Babylon, that Nebuchadnezzar has had enough, and he will destroy the city, take everybody else captive for the most part, and burn the temple to the ground. Okay, so these are the last days of Judah and Jerusalem. And remember that out of all of this carnage, God is still preserving the line of Christ. And where does it come from? Would be another question I could ask. It comes from the line of Jehoiachin, the son of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah. So that line of the kings is preserved through the exile, and eventually we learn in Matthew chapter 1 leads to Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, let's talk about the structure of Jeremiah, see if you can fill it out. On your handout again, I know I told you that if you were following the screen you could see everything, but I guess I lied to you. That's not true. You'll need the handout to see all these things in particular, but if you have the handout, take a second here to try to fill in the blanks that lay out the structure of the book of Jeremiah as we have been thinking about it. All right, Ian, we're good. Okay, I'll ask the folks here. We have been pointing out the symmetry of the book of Jeremiah, maybe a little forced, but this is what we've been working with. So we begin and end with oracles, messages, primarily messages of judgment, not exclusively, but mostly messages of judgment. In the first part of the book, chapter 1 to 25, these oracles are against who? Judah, the people of God, okay? And then at the end of the book, which we haven't got to yet, but we'll start on Wednesday, the oracles are against who? The nations, okay? Egypt, Philistia, Ammon, Moab, Babylon eventually, all that kind of stuff, okay? So that's how the book begins and ends. And then on either side of that, after the first oracles and before the last oracles, there are these interludes, these kind of spots of the book that break up the messages. And what do we call those? What kind of material's in there? Historical material. It's stories. What happened to Jeremiah? What happened with the kings that he's interacting with? So on and so forth. And we learn some pretty cool events that take place during the life of Jeremiah. And then right in the middle of all of that, there is a very distinct section that we call the Book of Comfort. It is the hopeful message of what God is looking forward to doing with and through his people after the punishment and the exile to Babylon. Specifically, as we read famously in chapter 31, when he makes a new covenant with the people through the Messiah, that is what the book is ultimately looking forward to. Okay, so with that in our mind then, let's go through each of these sections, or some of these sections, and do some fill-in-the-blanks like we've done before. If you're looking at your handout, you'll notice that I didn't give you all of the fill-in-the-blanks that I've given you in the past. I've slimmed them down, so you can be thankful for that. But there are a few in each section that we want to look at and remember. And again, the point of this is not just to have arbitrary memory work. I hope no one thinks that that's what this is about, that we're wasting time every so often with arbitrary facts and details that we're remembering. Maybe some of it is. I will hear that case if you have it. But with these in particular, what we're trying to do is remember the key language, remember the key words, the key verses, the key themes that appear in the book of Jeremiah, so that when you think of the book of Jeremiah going forward, some of these ideas, maybe even some of these phrases, will pop into your head, and you'll think, oh yeah, there's that verse in Jeremiah, uses this phrase, and that really is part of what the message of Jeremiah is. So try your hardest on these, don't look them up. I won't give you enough time to look them all up. But let's start with what we see. Oh, I forgot I had this for you here. This is the other way of outlining. The farther we got into the class, the less convinced I was of this outline. Okay, and Steve's nodding his head, so I feel good about that. But for instance, I mean, some of this stuff, like, you know, the section in 21 to 29, right, to kings and others. When you see that in an outline, you know that the person in the outline is trying to stretch it to make it work, right? Because he's like trying to be vague, like, oh yeah, this section is about addressing kings and other people. And then another section later on is to kings and other people. And it's like, well, that's hard to convince me that there's a really intentional distinction there. But it does at least point out in a similar way that the middle of this outline is, the middle of the book is about the hope and comfort. Okay. Do these first four. These come from the first 12 chapters, and see if you can fill in these blanks that are from that first section. All right, Ian. Okay, I'll let y'all yell them out. They have, for chapter 2, they've forsaken me, the fountain. That was good. And it's going to go downhill from there. You know, the first one is like everyone yelled it out, and then, you know, blah, 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 blah. And hewed out for themselves broken cisterns, yeah, that hold no water. Okay? That is the chief sin of the people right there. Rejection of God, the fountain of life, for something else that doesn't satisfy. Chapter 6, this is in reference to the false prophets who don't see a problem at all. Everything's fine here. They have healed the wound of my people lightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Trying to put a Band-Aid on a gushing wound, a fatal wound, okay? But God doesn't abandon the idea of peace. He's just saying the peace you're offering is superficial. It's fake. Instead, God is offering something much better. Two verses later. If you really change your ways, if you really repent, look for the ancient paths, walk in the good way, and you will find rest for your souls. That's what God is offering in opposition to the false message of the prophets. But it's hard because it takes digging out those ancient paths and repenting and turning back to those things, which are highly unpopular, of course. Okay, but chapter 7 paints a picture of what life is like, what the attitude of the people is like. Jeremiah in the temple says, has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? Commit all your iniquities and your injustices, but then hide out in the temple thinking we're going to be okay because we have the house that is called by God's name. Okay, look at the next four that come from chapters 13 to 20. And again, I'll give you 60 seconds or so to fill those out on your own. Funny how those first few, I remember this in Isaiah too, the first few, it was so easy to remember. And then as you go through a big book like this, it just comes hazier and hazier. You know? All right, we can go. All right, Robert said these are harder. So maybe you're experiencing that at home. I would agree that they become harder the more material you try to pack into your brain, the harder it is to fit it all in there. Chapter 17, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord. He will be like a tree planted by the waters. Remember the connection to Psalm 1. Maybe that can help you with this one. It's the same construction. Blessed is he will be like. In Psalm 1, it's the one who meditates on the words of God day and night. And then in this one, it's trust in the Lord. But same imagery of tree planted by the water. Okay. In contrast, the very next verse, the heart, the human heart, is more deceitful. Okay. Deceitful, deceptive, deceitful than all else, and it is desperately sick. Okay, a stunning description of the human condition in Jeremiah, but an accurate one, and one that we need to keep in mind and remember not to trust in ourselves. Okay, these last two are a little bit different. They relate to Jeremiah's own struggle. I wanted to keep in there a couple that refer to Jeremiah's hardship of being a prophet of God and the difficulty that came with that. And so, in his strongest language in the book, the high point or the low point of complaining, however you want to see that, he says to God, "Oh Lord, you have blank and I was blank. Yeah, you've deceived me." Again, this is strong language. God, you tricked me into this. I told you, chapter one, I told you I didn't want to do it. But he says, you have blank, and me and I have prevailed. You have overcome me. You forced me into this, God. And Jeremiah was saying that because he was preaching a message that not only was not received by the people, but resulted in him, and we read throughout the book of Jeremiah, if you put it all together, you see him left out, ostracized socially. We see him threatened, people plotting to take legal and even violent action against him. We see him beaten and put in stocks. We see him put in an open courtyard in prison. We see him thrown into a dungeon. We see him thrown into a muddy cistern, which apparently he would have died in had he not been rescued. We see him carried against his will to Egypt after it's all said and done. And so this was hard work for Jeremiah to do. And so he says, God, why are you having me do this? But two verses later, he says, but if I try to not speak, if I try to not fulfill the command that God has given me and keep the word to myself, then it becomes in me like a burning fire. Yeah, I can't but preach this. Maybe similar, we would say, to what the apostles said in the book of Acts. We cannot help but speak what it is that we've seen and heard. And Jeremiah maybe was experiencing something similar to that. Okay, the next section here, just a few more of these, 21 to 29. Take a minute to look at these. Okay, we'll go to good, Ian. I need to pick up the pace a little bit here. I will raise up in chapter 23. This is one of those. Remember, the first 25 chapters is not all judgment of God. It is also, there are embedded in that messages of the future and of a hope. And so in chapter 23, for instance, he says, I will raise up for David a branch, key word in the prophets. He will reign as king and do act wisely and do the two things. This is the two key words for kings, justice and righteousness. Okay, that's what he will do, in contrast to what the kings of Judah had been doing. Okay, and then the specific prophecy we referenced earlier, the whole land will be a desolation and a horror. These nations will serve the king of Babylon. How many years? 70 years for the Babylonians to be in power before it all comes crashing down. With the writing on the wall and all that stuff. Okay, chapter 25, speaking of God ruling in those kingdoms of man, take this cup of wine of, what does the cup of wine represent? The wrath of God from my hand and cause all, who to drink it? Who's going to drink God's wrath? All the nations, I'd take people, but specifically here, the nations will drink the wrath of God. For everyone from Judah to Babylon will drink of it in chapter 25. But for God's people in chapter 29, that even with this pending doom, even still, God says, I know the plans I have for you, plans for peace or welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. Yeah, a hopeful future. Again, a famous verse, but a verse that does need to be understood in its context. The immediate future is very bleak. It's going to be awful. But if you will, for those who trust in God, we would say, for that remnant that stays faithful to Him, the end of the story is one in which God will bless His people. Okay, 30 to 33. Let's just I'll give you 30 seconds. Hate to take away all your time. I want you to at least put in forth some effort. I'm seeing our number of viewers just drop slowly. People are just, tired of this. They can't hold on any longer. So we will try to pick up the pace here a little bit. But take a few seconds to look at this. All right, Ian. Okay, chapter 30, verse 3. This is the phrase that appears all through the prophets and even in the Psalms, among other places, that this captures what it is that God is going to do for his people. We talked about the idea of reversal is what this is insinuating. But what's the phrase? Behold, days are coming when I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. Things are going to turn around is the idea of that. Okay. And that lays out everything else that's going to happen. But chapter 31, we've referenced this already. Behold, days are coming when I will make a new covenant, not like the old covenant that I made with their fathers. The next chapter, speaking of that same covenant, they will be my people and I will be their God. Another phrase that's literally, from Genesis to Revelation in our Bibles. And I will give them, what kind of heart and way will they have? One, unified heart and way. Because God will give them a new heart and write on it himself. Okay, and then to the perpetual kingdom that is being looked forward to, two things that will never lack. Oh, I gave you the first one here. I forgot how I laid it out here. Okay, so David will never lack a man to sit on the throne. What else will never lack in the kingdom? Yeah, the Levitical priest, which again, that's kind of weird, because Jesus is not a Levitical priest. But again, the point is not so much the specific tribe of the Levites as much as it is that God will have a priest, a high priest forever to stand before him in Jesus, and that we in the kingdom serve as ourselves a kingdom of priests, according to 1 Peter 2, perpetually. Okay, then I will just go through these without giving you time to think about them. This is just what happened in this this historical section of Jeremiah from 34 to 45. Not every chapter, but let's go through these. In chapter 35, the Rechabites stay faithful to the commands of their ancestor by doing what? Yeah, refusing to drink wine because they were listening to the words of their forefather, unlike the people listening to their God. In chapter 36, Jehoiakim hears the scroll of the Jeremiah written by Baruch and responds by cutting it up into pieces and burning it in the fire. Okay. In chapter 38, Jeremiah is thrown into a muddy cistern, as we said before, until he's rescued by an Ethiopian eunuch. Okay, maybe my favorite character of the whole Bible. Chapter 39, Jerusalem finally in chapter 39 is destroyed, and what happens to Zedekiah? His eyes are put out after his sons are killed, so not a great end, although he is left alive, whatever that's worth. And then in 41 to 43, we have an ongoing account here of Johanan and the remaining Jews left in Judah. They defy Jeremiah's warning and do what? And go to Egypt for safety, they say. Okay, and that's really where we ended up. In chapter 44, which is what we studied on Wednesday, we saw the last message, really, that Jeremiah has in his lifetime, which is to the people in Egypt to say, judgment is coming on Egypt and on you that are in Egypt, just as it came on those in Judah. You cannot escape God's wrath. And in fact, by fleeing here, and more than that, by continuing to worship idols in Egypt, you are bringing God's wrath upon yourself. There will be no survivors, even though you have fled here for safety. And that was really the end of Jeremiah's message to the people, at least the last thing that's said. And then we have, in chapter 45, very strangely, a very short account of a message that Jeremiah gives, not to the people, broadly, but specifically to Baruch, who we've talked about some already. Baruch is the scribe of Jeremiah. Remember, he was the one that wrote down the words of Jeremiah. He also acted as Jeremiah's like assistant or even his attorney. He was the one that got all the paperwork together for Jeremiah to buy that property earlier in the book. And so this is Baruch. He's a sidekick, so to speak, of Jeremiah. And there is a message for him here in chapter 45 before the rest of the book is then devoted to messages for the nations. Why is this here? I don't know. Why we talked about Jeremiah's out of order. It's confusing and all that. Some people see this as Baruch's way of signing the book, like a signature. Remember how Paul, at the end of some of his letters, I should say this. At the end of Paul's letters, you know, the person who wrote it will kind of say, like, who's one guy? Is it Tertius or Tertullus or something like that? Says, I wrote this with my own hand, you know. I did all the hard work. You know, Paul just told me what to write. Maybe Baruch is doing something similar here, that he's including this passage right here at the end of the messages and stories of Jeremiah to say, this is me signing the book, so to speak. But for whatever reason it's here, I think we will see something encouraging and helpful in the message for understanding the book of Jeremiah and even for ourselves. So this is the last page of your handout, the few lines that we have here about chapter 45. Let's read it and go over it before we quit. Chapter 45, this is the message which Jeremiah the prophet spoke to Baruch, the son of Neriah, when he had written down these words in a book at Jeremiah's dictation in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, to you, O Baruch. You said, ah, woe is me, for the Lord has added sorrow to my pain. I am weary with my groaning and have found no rest. Thus you are to say to him, thus says the Lord, behold, what I have built, I am about to tear down. What I have planted, I am about to uproot. That is the whole land. But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them. For behold, I am going to bring disaster on all flesh, declares the Lord, but I will give your life to you as booty in all the places where you may go. Okay, again, this is something that came earlier. It's stuck here at this point in the book, but it is addressed to Baruch, as we said, the scribe and assistant of Jeremiah, and it comes in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. This is an important year that we've already seen quite a bit of things happening in. Back in chapter 25, we learn that the fourth year of Jehoiakim is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, so this is 605 here. Remember, if you look back at your chart or the chart earlier, 609 was when Jehoiakim took the throne. 605 is the year that Nebuchadnezzar comes to power. He finally defeats the Egyptians at Carchemish, and he is the big kid on the block now, king of Babylon. And in Daniel 1, it says that this is the very year that those first captives were taken. So it's a big year. It's the year that really seals the fate for what's going to happen to Judah. It's also, coincidentally, the same year, the same time that that whole event with the burning scroll took place. The year when, according to chapter 36, Jeremiah had Baruch write down all the words. It was eventually passed along to the king, Jehoiakim, who tore it up and destroyed it. Okay, maybe that's in view here. I don't know if this had just happened. Maybe it was about to happen. Maybe Baruch just, you know, understood the situation they were in. But I do think it is an interesting connection, because this message comes to Baruch for a reason. It says here that Baruch is worn out. He's tired of it all, okay? He's cried out to God. He is like Jeremiah. He has said, woe is me. Literally, he says, woe is me. We always say that, you know, oh, woe is me. No, Baruch said, woe is me. The Lord has added to my sorrow pain. I am weary with my groaning and have found no rest. Interesting, this idea of rest, right? The prophets, the false prophets, were saying everything's fine now, when things were about to, you know, be horrible. For Baruch and for Jeremiah, they did not have rest in the moment. They were weary in the moment, but they believed, or at least God told them, that there would be rest later on. So interesting contrast there. But, you know, this is interesting. It wasn't just Jeremiah that was hurting in all of this. We've seen Baruch involved with the work of Jeremiah. We even saw, what chapter was that? 41? 43, I guess it was, when Baruch was blamed, remember, for being the mastermind behind the plot of Jeremiah to lie to the people about going to Egypt. They said, Baruch's putting you up to this. So clearly Baruch was, like Jeremiah, experiencing the same sort of rejection for being on the side of truth, for not wavering and saying, this is what God has said, and I'm going to live by it. And again, I think we could sympathize to some degree with Baruch, knowing that to stand for that means to face difficulty. But here's the message that God has for him. First of all, God says in verse 4, Baruch, there's something bigger going on here. I am destroying what I've built. I think one thing God may be saying here is, you think this is hard for you, Baruch? You think you're experiencing pain? You think you're experiencing sorrow? Here I am, taking the people that I chose, the place that is called by my name, the land which I promised to Israel, and I'm destroying all of it. You think that's easy for me, Baruch? We've seen this earlier in the book of Jeremiah. We shouldn't forget how painful it is for God to bring even a just punishment upon people that he loves and cares about. So that may be the first thing that God would say is, put this in perspective, Baruch. Okay? And that's good for us to remember too, that our life is hard, our life may be difficult, we may, because of our commitment to Christ, experience difficult things. The first thing to do is just to see the big picture. Okay, this is not about us. God is has this eternal plan. He is the one that is not only in control, but he is the one that is dealing with all of this evil and this wickedness, and it hurts him. And yet, his will is perfect. Okay, so it's kind of broadening the perspective. And then to say, specifically to Baruch, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do you want this, you know, to all turn out good for you? You want to experience, you know, great things right now? He says, don't seek them. I'm not exactly sure what Baruch maybe wanted or what God is calling out in Baruch specifically. But again, I think we probably need to hear the same things. This is not about us. Are we thinking that by serving Christ, this is somehow going to be great for me? That I'm going to get, you know, popular and famous, and I'm going to gain a lot of influence, or I'm going to get wealthy, or I'm going to be happy, or, you know, am I seeking great things for myself? Is that why I've chosen this path? what God says to Baruch is, that's not what this is about. This is not about you increasing your influence, not about you increasing your position. In fact, he says in the end, through all of the destruction, all through the punishment, all you have to do, all you can do, all that you will do is trust God, and by trusting him, you will escape with your life. That will be the spoils of war, as we've seen the language used before. And again, I think this is the message of the gospel, that to save our life, we lose it. That to come to Christ is to make a very humble admission, a confession of our own sins, a confession of our own weakness, and an admission to say, I don't want anything out of this, God. It's not about me. I simply want to live. I simply want life that only you can provide, as we've talked about this morning. And whatever that means for me, whatever burden that means I will bear, whatever sacrifice that means I will make, I just want to live with Christ. I just want to be with him. God says, if you trust in me, you will. You'll live. Even if we lose everything else. In fact, Jesus says we will lose everything else. But even if we suffer great loss, we will live and have our life, not just now, but have our life forever because we've trusted in Jesus and he's carried us through the difficulty. Okay, that's chapter 45, and then we will shift gears greatly on Wednesday, looking at chapter 46 and 47 and the beginning of the oracles against the nations. For those of you that held on with us through all of that, thank you, and we will see you soon. Look forward to engaging in our studies again throughout this week.